It's Sunday morning. Time for the Great Outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. And today marks the 26th anniversary of the 26th year that I first came on WGN Radio, succeeding the legendary and great friend of mine, Bill Cullerton. I cannot believe that 26 years has passed, and that means that the Great Outdoors Show has been on WGN Radio now for 56 consecutive years. Of course, it was on Saturday mornings for a long time, and then maybe over the last 15 years, we've been coming to you on Sunday mornings. So it's been a great fun, and hopefully this is a great 26th year for the Great Outdoors Show with me hosting and you enjoying it. I'm going to start off with a comment right out of the box about things going on in Washington. As you know, I don't do political shows, but I try to cover issues of interest. And last week I mentioned, because it was the breaking news, that Venezuela was going to be going through a change, and that that was extremely good for migratory birds and neotropical birds. In the subsequent week, I have come to learn just how extensive the damage to Venezuela's wetlands and migratory bird habitat may have been over the past decade to 15 years. And it's a tremendous opportunity now to help restore in the coming years some of the most important wetlands in the Western Hemisphere. So forget the whole concept and discussion about, what is this legal? Is it right? Is it wrong? Let's just look at it from a natural resource perspective for a moment. And I don't mean oil and gas. I mean the natural resources of wetlands and migratory birds, waterfowl, neotropical birds. Venezuela is at a nexus of the two continents, South America, North America, with many North American birds wintering in Venezuela and returning to the United States and Canada, particularly the prairies, to breed. So the wetlands degradation in Venezuela has been significant. And part of it is because of how poorly oil is being refined in Venezuela with lots of pollution. So it is possible, in fact, I would hope it is very likely, that one of the priorities coming forth out of the conservation community in the Venezuela going forward is to try and establish a mechanism to restore some of the most important wetlands and clean them up in Venezuela for the benefit of migratory and neotropical birds. And when Al Lab says we have 3 billion less birds in America than we did 50 years ago, they're the only ones with the data that have run the numbers, whether it's 3 billion, I said this often, whether it's 3 billion or 100 million, what matters is we have a lot fewer birds, and there's seldom just one cause. Is it pesticides? Is it chemicals? Is it things happening on the winter grounds, migratory corridors, breeding grounds? They're all factors that come into being to cause a population to decline. And certainly what's happened in Venezuela over the past 20 years cannot be viewed as having been beneficial for migratory birds, neotropical birds, waterfowl. So that's one thing I wanted to mention as we move on from that discussion of a week ago to something that is right in front of us right now, game farm mallards. We now know that game farm mallards would be mallards that are released into the wild from game farms, essentially. And it was always assumed, and I touched on this several months ago, it was always assumed that the game farm mallards raised in captivity with non-wild genetics and released into the wild did not migrate and did not survive. That was assumed by the scientists, not necessarily assumed by a lot of people who spend time in the outdoors, my being one of them. Particularly in the Atlantic Flyway, where game farm mallards have been released by the millions over the past decades for the point of view of trying to provide hunting opportunity. So game farm mallard genetics are a much bigger problem than the scientists ever thought. And it's now believed that this is possible, that only 2% of the mallards in the Atlantic Flyway are fully wild. If that's the case, we need to do something about this. And I guess you have to assume that it is the case, and that the genetics of the inferior genetics of game farm mallards. Game farm mallards don't have the instinctive abilities to migrate as far. Their wings are shorter. Their bills are shorter. They're made to feed differently. Their necks are shorter. Their bodies are smaller. And when those genetics get mixed with wild birds, which means the hens or the drakes of game farm mallards are actually migrating with wild birds, and they are actually going to up and down the Atlantic Flyway. Some may be crossing over into the prairies and coming to the Mississippi Flyway. We don't have that kind of data yet, but I would offer, as a longtime fan, as you all know, of waterfowl hunting and my love of and passion for ducks, and not only their propagation and protection, but also the rich heritage of duck hunting that it has in America and has had with my family for generations. We are making a serious mistake, my personal view, in having game farm genetics get into wild populations. And there's going to be now a lot of discussion on this. A paper was done in the early 1990s by Frank Rauer, the longtime chief scientist of the Delta Waterfowl Foundation, that said that game farm mallards genetics could not get into wild bird populations because they couldn't migrate with the birds. Well, the best science at that time, and Dr. Rauer is arguably the top waterfowl scientist of our generation. He's in the likes with Al Hochbaum when it comes to people who really understood waterfowl and committed their life. He's a top researcher. And with the information available in the early 90s and with the ability to collect information, Dr. Rauer wrote a paper saying there was very little probability that game farm mallards could migrate with wild birds, and therefore their genetics would not get into the wild population. Well, here we are some 30 plus years later with all kinds of new technology and new abilities to monitor DNA or to evaluate DNA and genetics. And we find out that Dr. Rauer's assumptions were not correct, even though they were done with the best of science at the time. So here we are with a whole set of new information. And what are we going to do about it? So the rampant crossbreeding appears to be an issue across all four flyways. And there is now going to be extensive research to help determine the extent of the problem. But it is an issue that could transform wild migratory birds. And apparently game farm mallards genetics are now found in 45 of the 48 lower 48 states with different prevalence rates across the four flyways. The Atlantic Flyway, the Mississippi Flyway, it appears that there are about 20 to 25% of the mallards that are shot in the Mississippi Flyway have game farm genetics. The Central Flyway, 11, and the Pacific Flyway, 15%. And as I mentioned, the Atlantic Flyway, they found 98% of mallards in the Atlantic Flyway had some kind of game farm genetics. So this is going to be, I think it's really an issue of our time. More than 4,000 duck hunters participated in the study by sending in wing samples and other parts of birds for genetic sampling. So the Fish and Wildlife Service is now very much aware that we have a colossal problem. On the other side of the equation, there is a lot of industry that is built into the game farm business and the propagation of waterfowl, captive waterfowl that are non-wild. There are all kinds of clubs. There are all kinds of release programs, particularly in the Southeast. South Carolina has built an entire industry around releasing game farm mallards into the wild to provide hunting opportunity, which people would say gives people the reason to have habitat. It's a complicated issue, but what's not complicated is that the genetics of wild birds are being compromised. And I, for one, and I think a lot of people who I know feel this is not something that we want to see happen. So we'll see what happens in the coming year. There's much more to come, but the news is now out. Seismic sea change from what we thought to be the case. I'll be back in just a moment with much more of the Great Outdoors. And when I do, I'm going to talk about deer hunting and reforestation efforts in a group called the Eco Hunting Alliance, a really interesting story of anti-hunters who are now hunters. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN. And first, a message from our longtime sponsors, the Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
Hiking, camping, and hunting, it's all an adventure in the great outdoors, but nature can be tough. You need to be ready for anything and everything. Chevy Silverado is built to handle the toughest conditions and get you everywhere you want to go, worry-free. Silverado's designed to handle the big jobs. It's built for the great outdoors. With over 13,000 pounds of towing capacity and trailering sway control, Silverado can haul the biggest loads on the roughest roads and keep you cool as a Sunday drive. With 8 available cameras and up to 14 different views, it can spot trouble before it gets to you. That's peace of mind. And when you're ready for the backcountry, Chevy Silverado 1500 ZR2 owns the off-road. You name it, we run over it. No wonder it's Motor Trend's 2023 four-wheeler pickup truck of the year. So see your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and check out a Chevy Silverado. It's freedom to explore the great outdoors.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host. Hope you're enjoying the show this morning. Going to switch to a subject which I talk about a lot, and that is the importance of hunting for conservation, because I do think it's something that's extremely misunderstood in our ever-urbanized society. As we get further and further from the land, we do not understand the importance of hunting and wildlife management. However, there's a group of former anti-hunters who are now recognizing why hunting deer is so important to managing habitat. There is a group in New York called Eco Hunting Alliance. And what has happened is that there was a 13-acre test site in Columbia County in New York that has been excluded from deer. We've done this in the Midwest. We've done this all across the country. And wildflowers have become reestablished. Tupelo and sassafras trees have now grown. Red maple stumps sprout, and oak saplings are thriving. Outside the fence, you have a monoculture of overgrazed forest up to the top of the browse line. And if you living in Illinois or listening, think about this. If you're driving down, in particular, Interstate 294 or along a forest preserve anywhere, and you look inside the fence, you can see the forest floor all the way through. And the browse line, it goes to about head high, which is if you're about a 6-foot person, which is about as high as a deer can reach. And there is nothing growing under 6 feet. So the saplings that should be growing and sprouting are eaten by the deer. All the flowers are eaten by the deer. We are ending up with a monoculture of forests in which there is no natural reforestation taking place. And eventually all the trees are going to grow up, get old, and die. And we're not going to have any rejuvenation. And this monoculture of overgrazed forest is true across much of the country north and east of the Mississippi River. So in New York, there was a group of people who say that they were, and it's ladies, by the way, interestingly, who were amazed at what they saw taking place at the Red Hook Native Base Plant and Landscaping Rewilding Project called led by Zoe Evans. She realized that what she was looking at inside a fence could be possible outside a fence, but only if the number of deer were controlled. So she founded Eco Hunting Alliance Hudson Valley. And the group describes themselves as eco hunters. They're, quote unquote, focused on hunting wildlife in ways that promotes healthier ecosystem. Their goal is to bring new hunters into the fold, to share sustainable practice with experienced hunters, and to push for regulatory changes that would meaningfully reduce deer populations. End of quote. Wow. A group that is focused on wildlife, hunting wildlife in ways that promote healthier ecosystems. I'd like to think that there are, and there are, 12 to 15 million Americans every year that have been doing this for a long time. And in fact, it used to be over 20 million Americans doing this. We hunt because we love the food, and we know that hunting is important to the management of habitat. And when it comes to deer, we have an overpopulation of deer virtually everywhere. So the fact that groups and individuals that actually were avowed anti-hunters did not hunt are now recognizing that hunting can, in fact, be not only can be, but is imperative to the management of wildlife populations is just more evidence that what we've been saying, and I'm not preaching here, but that what people have been saying for a long time is true. The best conservationists are hunters. The way to manage most wildlife populations is through hunting. And if you want to have sustainable and wildlife populations, you need to have hunting because it's hunters who take care of them. So congratulations to the Eco Hunting Alliance based out of New York. I hope that your message spreads across the country. That would be absolutely fantastic. As I sign off, here's a story out across the big pond out of Britain. Britain asked a power plant to build a fish disco. It's not going well. The world's most expensive nuclear station is trying to frighten fish with a deep sea boombox. But the DJing fish, the DJs that are playing the music to save marine life, is not working. The aim was pretty simple. The British call it prevent murder on the seafloor. Over a decade ago, British environmental regulators approved a nuclear power station with the provision its cooling system wouldn't suck in millions of fish from the British Channel. So the French company building the plant, think about that, the French building a plant in England, that shows cooperation, promised a novel solution. They would construct an elaborate noise machine, a.k.a. a disco fish machine to scare away the fish. It turns out it didn't work. Different fish move to different tunes. High frequency noises deter shad, but might be harmful to dolphins. Some of the tunes they play actually attracted fish, which communicate using high frequencies. Trout and salmon need more bass. Eels, it turns out, unhelpfully have ears behind their eyes, and they only respond to lights flashing. So the idea that we could play music on the ocean floor to keep fish away from the cooling system of a nuclear power plant turns out to be totally false. And, of course, there was no research done in advance before they spent the tens of millions to do this. So we have different fish species leaving the plant area. We have others that are attracted by the noise, and we have some that are affected, not affected at all. So the system requires miles of cable linking 288 underwater speakers blaring sounds louder than a jumbo jet 24 hours a day. But it's not working. So at the cost of tens of millions of dollars to construct and maintain, it's turned out that it won't save fish at all. I guess you could say this whole thing sounds fishy. I'm not sure. But anyway, that's the report from across the pond. So if we have any ideas here that fish will respond to music, sounds, and leave, they won't. And it makes me think of the electric barriers that we put in the rivers and particularly Lake Calumet area to stop the Asian carp from coming to the Great Lakes. One thing we do know, fish do respond to high-voltage electricity. They stay away. Thanks so much for listening. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN. I'll be back next week with much more in the great outdoors.